On Monday, we spoke with Michael Kimmelman and Vashon Chakrabarty about proposed changes to Penn Station and how they could affect millions of commuters every day. New York seems like a city that's always changing, and changes to Penn Station are badly needed. Yet for this week's weekend bonus podcast, we thought we would look at some important ways New York has preserved its architectural legacies. In 2008, Anthony Wood joined me to discuss his book, Preserving New York, Winning the Right to Protect the City's Landmarks. In 2013, Sam Roberts of the New York Times talked about the centennial of Grand Central Terminal. And in 2014, Andrew Berman, executive director of the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation, and Michael Kimmelman joined me to discuss protecting Greenwich Village from overdevelopment. Enjoy. As New York's housing market continues to boom and the city constantly sheds its skin, we can rest relatively easy knowing that its major landmarks will be protected. But it wasn't always that way. In Preserving New York, Winning the Right to Protect the City's Landmarks, preservationist Anthony C. Wood tells the story of how New York's nationally acclaimed landmarks law was passed in 1965 and of the numerous architectural treasures that were demolished before its passage. The book is published by Routledge. It's my pleasure to welcome Anthony Wood to the show today. Hello.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, many New Yorkers will tell you that the preservation movement began with the demolition of Pennsylvania Station in the 1960s, but you say it started a lot earlier.
Indeed, it did. Penn Station has had such a powerful impact on our collective consciousness in the city that there really is this myth of Penn Station. And it was a building worthy of a myth. I mean, the massive and beautiful monumental.
Who designed it?
I'm not going to have all of that at my fingertips for you. But it was based on, actually a link to your earlier subject, on the Roman bath of Caracalla. So, I mean, there's an interesting link historically between all these things. The myth of the station not only comes from the place it occupied in the city, but also the long demolition. I mean, it took 3 years to tear down the station. And while that was happening, they were building above, and so people went through this. So it really began to sear itself on the consciousness of the city. So that's kind of become the shorthand for how we got the landmarks law. Yet, indeed, you're right. It goes back. I take the storyline back to at least 1913.
Well, I just want to sit on Penn Station one more moment.
Yeah, please.
That destruction with the building of the new building really said a lot, because a very beautiful building was being destroyed while a rather ugly building was being put up. Perhaps if a great example of modern architecture had replaced the old Penn Station, people would have been less upset.
I don't know that that's the case. I think, well, for one thing,
many people protested when a very nice building on Park Avenue was destroyed and the Lever House replaced it. A couple of years ago, when there was talk about taking down the Lever House, the same people who picketed the destruction of the previous building said, oh, here we go again. Now we have to go and protect the Lever House.
Well, absolutely. But I think that the Penn Station, for one thing, there weren't that many people who were upset at the time. It was only a handful of New Yorkers, really several hundreds at the most, who tried to do something to save Penn Station. So it's kind of an after-the-fact awareness, and that sense of loss grew over with the passage of time.
So was the desire to preserve the past seen as a kind of elitist thing?
It was basically, those would be maybe more words we'd use today. I think at the time, preservation was not the dominant thinking in the country. I mean, it was all about, we'd just gone through the 50s. Everything was about new and modern. So it was against the mindset of the city. And it took a whole concerted effort to kind of change that consciousness. And ultimately, it took the continued loss of buildings because, Penn Station went down in 63. We didn't get the law till 65, and there were other buildings being lost and being threatened after that.
Grand Central Terminal.
Well, Grand Central had actually been threatened as early as the mid-50s. And in fact, that had led to what's known as the BART Act, which was the authorizing legislation passed in 1965. 1956 that actually gave New York the ability to ultimately have the law. So there was a lot of interest, but it didn't have a public voice or a public will to translate it into policy until the 60s.
My guest is Anthony Wood, who's written a book called Preserving New York, Winning the Right to Protect a City's Landmarks, published by Routledge. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It was called the Bard Law after Alfred Bard.
Albert Bard, indeed.
What is his role in this history?
Well, Bard is one of a number of great New York civic figures who's almost been lost in, as they say, the dustbin of history. And one of the great joys I had in this book was uncovering people like Bard. And Bard was this wonderful New York lawyer who was involved with many civic groups for decades. He just would never say die. He had a wicked sense of humor. And in 1913, he had the radical notion that cities ought to be able to regulate on the ground of aesthetics. And finally, in 1956, that's kind of what the Bard Law actually says, that, you know, a city has the right to talk about beauty and to control and regulate on the grounds of beauty. And what's great is Bard lived through that whole period and never said die. He would keep advancing this. You know, 1938, he tried to bring it forward. He just kept at it with this wonderful New York stubbornness.
Now, he had been inspired by the Chicago World's Fair in 1893.
Well, many New Yorkers, I mean, it's interesting, New Yorkers were so involved in creating, the New York architects were involved in creating the Columbia Exposition, and New Yorkers went there. And what it was they saw what a city could be on the shores of Lake Michigan, and they wanted to have that type of city on the banks of the Hudson. And so they came back and they created groups like the Municipal Art Society. And it was those art societies that helped advance that aesthetic agenda in the city and stuck with it from 1913 to the passage of the law.
But an awful lot of wonderful buildings were demolished along the way.
Oh, I mean, and the irony is actually, even with our law, we continue to lose buildings. There's a wonderful quote from, a lawsuit that says, the price of preservation is constant vigilance. And in essence, it's an ongoing struggle, and we've lost a lot, but the wonderful thing for us is we have saved so much, and there's so much more that we really need to protect, because as you mentioned at the beginning, the mayor's plan 2030 says we're going to have 1 million more New Yorkers with all the infrastructure and the housing that's going to be required. That's going to put intense pressure on buildings that we haven't yet secured their protection.
During all of this time, were other cities instituting preservation programs?
New York looked to other cities who were ahead of us in certain aspects. As early as the 1940s, New Yorkers were writing the Vieux Carré Commission in New Orleans saying, how did you guys do it? And they looked to Charleston, South Carolina, and they looked at Alexandria, Virginia. So they looked, but they didn't find a model that would work for New York City.
But Chicago could have been a model because it's a city that didn't have a landmarks law, but understood that it had certain treasures that could not be destroyed.
Actually, there's some interesting parallels between preservation efforts in Chicago. There was a big battle in the early 60s in Chicago to save the Garrick Theater. And they had their group of picketers in front, like we had with Penn Station. There are some similarities in the journey these cities have to go through to get the protection power.
One of the lightning rods in this story is Robert Moses. Any number of times.
Yeah. Moses is the Darth Vader, of this piece. He started life on the, as a Jedi warrior, and then he went to the dark side of the Force. And he, frankly, probably did more for preservation than anyone else because he so incensed the civic leaders of New York, who I think were more left to their natural devices, would have probably not protested. But he just took things over the top.
His proposal for the Battery Brooklyn Link,
yes.
Which meant the destruction of Castle Clinton?
Right. One of the great battles in the history of preservation is an 11-year struggle led by a wonderful guy named George McEnany, and Bard was involved with it and some of the great civic leaders, battling Moses to save Castle Clinton. And indeed, that helped launch, just before World War II, some concerted thinking by the Municipal Art Society about the need to protect landmarks. Unfortunately, Pearl Harbor kind of put that agenda on hold, and it then heated up again in the early 50s. New York began to lose more buildings, and the Municipal Art Society and other groups picked up where they left off.
Then there was the proposal to destroy much of what we now call Soho.
Soho, absolutely. And
that whole area is now landmarked.
Indeed, and thanks largely to a lady mentioned in my book, Margot Gale, who, believe it or not, turns 100 this spring.
She's been a guest on the show.
Margot is an exemplar of a couple of takeaways from the history of preservation, and one is that we've just been so blessed with a group of people who refuse to accept that it was inevitable that we would have to lose these things. And so people like Margot, who've literally fought decade after decade after decade, and one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is capture that history, because I think it's so inspiring to the people today who are still trying to save buildings in the city.
But there are people who still remember the Ritz-Carlton, for example,
with great
fondness. It was considered the finest of all hotels. And that was destroyed in the 1950s. What justified the destruction of these places? They just weren't making money anymore?
Well, it's location, 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 real estate pressure, all the things that we see still happening today. You know, any building in New York whose only protection is that it's not economically viable to tear it down yet, those economics keep changing as the city becomes more and more superheated. So you could make money tearing down a vast building like the Ritz-Carlton and replace it. That was one of the buildings, indeed, that did shock kind of the civic community, say, wow, if that building could be torn down, you know, what's next?
And then there were plans to destroy some of Greenwich Village.
Oh, absolutely. Greenwich Village had to fight off Robert Moses for decades for plans to – he was going to put widen roads and put them through Washington Square Park. And again, it was Shirley Hayes, a wonderful mother, who led one of the battles against that, and ultimately there was a civic coalition. So what the Village did and Brooklyn Heights was they provided the ground troops for preservation.
But what we see is areas where people who are affluent and who have some political clout can prevent the destruction. The same sort of thing didn't happen in less benighted areas.
It's true. I mean, there is a political dimension in fighting for anything in the city, in civics. In Brooklyn, Brooklyn Heights was also successfully able to fight off Moses. So a lot depended on, I think, also where there were people who had the intellectual capital as well as the connections and the time.
What about city officials? Weren't they caught up in this? I would have thought any number would have said, we have to preserve the beauty of this city. It's what brings tourists here.
No. I'll have to tell you, somebody told me a few years ago, I don't know if it's true or not, they said the only two laws they know of that the public demanded were the Landmarks Law and the Pooper Scooper Law. I can't speak to the Pooper Scooper Law, but I can tell you the Landmarks Law is the result of the citizens of New York demanding it and finally getting government to open the door, begin to think about how to do it. And then the citizens were brought in to help shape it.
When treasures were threatened in neighborhoods like Harlem or Flatbush, was there a public outcry?
There has been at times. Even today, we need much more advocacy to protect those neighborhoods. They didn't play a key role in the narrative that I tell leading to the law. And I think there are a lot of disempowered communities that were lost. And when you look at what was up for grabs, so like in Brooklyn Heights, there's this incredible area of Brooklyn Heights that Moses was going to tear down as part of urban renewal. And when you see it today and you think, wow, if this was going to be torn down, what else did we lose in those neighborhoods that weren't able to fight off Moses?
My guest is Anthony C. Wood, a preservationist, historian, teacher, the executive director of the Idelson Foundation, and he's worked for the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Municipal Arts Society. He's also an adjunct assistant professor of historic preservation at Columbia University, and he's written a book called Preserving New York, Winning the Right to Protect a City's Landmark. We are back with Anthony C. Wood, who has written a book called Preserving New York, Winning the Right to Protect a City's Landmarks. It is published by Routledge. And it's in this large format book largely because you had to put in pictures. It would have been impossible to tell the story without these pictures.
The pictures are key, and unlike a kind of a traditional architecture book, which this is not, I wanted to have illustrations of the people involved. And I wanted to get illustrations showing what New Yorkers were looking up when they opened the New York Times and New York Herald Tribune in the 50s and saw a picture of a threatened building or saw a rally. So we really went out of our way to try and get pictures that would help really tell this really, to me it's almost a miraculous story that here a city that so prides itself on constant change figured out a way to actually select buildings they wanted to and neighborhoods they wanted to bring into the future.
But as you suggested earlier, there were parallel preservation movements that sprung up in Brooklyn Heights and Greenwich Village.
They
didn't see themselves as allies?
It's funny. You know what you're doing. And so the neighborhoods focused. There wasn't that much cross-pollinization initially between the neighborhoods. Writing this book was kind of like a game of Parcheesi because there were a number of interweaving storylines that one had to follow. And one of the storylines was what was happening at the citywide level by groups like the Municipal Arts Society, the citywide groups. The other storyline was what was happening in these neighborhoods where kind of independently the Village started because they had a greater sense of being historic longer. Brooklyn Heights really didn't wake up to the fact it was historic or special till the 1950s when a new wave of young professionals, one of them who are mentioned in the book is Otis Pratt Pierce, who's still very much with us today and can tell the story himself. But
I mean, people did not realize that those wonderful-looking old buildings had any more significance other than as housing for people who wanted to be close to Manhattan?
They talked about it, about the quality of life of Brooklyn Heights. They didn't have any of the language of architectural history or importance or preservation that the Village had used. And the Village for years had thought of itself like the Vieux Carré or Charleston, South Carolina. Brooklyn Heights hadn't seen those parallels.
Even though the buildings are as old in many cases.
Well, in the building, I mean, look at the quality of the neighborhood. But what's ironic is that even though Greenwich Village had this sense of history and a sense of its own importance decades before Brooklyn Heights, when Brooklyn Heights woke up to this in the late 50s, Brooklyn Heights actually went on and drafted its own version of a landmarks law and was actually trying to push that forward independently, just a law that would protect Brooklyn Heights. So though they came late to the party, when they got to the party, they brought a lot to the table.
But we already had an organization that was set up to fight this fight, the Municipal Arts Society. Why didn't it have more of an impact in those days?
Well, actually, it had quite an impact in those days. And one of the things, the Municipal Arts Society grew out of that City Beautiful movement. And so it was all about aesthetics. And preservation is a piece of that, but isn't the whole story. But really, the Municipal Arts Society gets credit for driving a multi-pronged campaign starting in the early 50s. You had to begin by identifying what were these buildings you cared about. I mean, so they actually spearheaded a wonderful survey that took a number of years that they did with the Society for Architectural Historians that created a list. And that was the intellectual capital that then was used for walking tours. I mean, today, you know, you can't walk down the sidewalks. They're cluttered with walking tours. In 1956, that was the cutting edge. That was new. And so it was the Municipal Arts Society with that list, with the walking tours. They helped with a plaque program, exhibits. They began to educate New Yorkers. They were beginning to build a constituency. They, however, were not able to reach massive numbers. They were almost all a volunteer organization. They're not like the Municipal Arts Society we know today with the kind of the resources it has. So they were working at the citywide level, but it was in the neighborhoods that you actually got hundreds of people to turn out at rallies and protests.
Well, the Municipal Arts Society was brought in to evaluate Bruce Ratner's proposals for the development of the Atlantic Yards, and it said they were poorly designed. They would have hoped for something different. They have not been listened to by anybody.
Well, you know, historic observations in this book is I use the history to help better understand where we are today. And I think part of the problem we have today still is that the type of advocacy being done by groups like the Municipal Arts Society was an advocacy that reflects actually the dynamics of the 60s and a set of relationships and a set of societal forces that have changed. And I think one of the challenges for groups like that is to reinvent how to be effective in a radically changed city. And they've got a ways to go.
Well, there's also the problem that there's nothing really distinguished about the architecture that is in that area. It's just a question of whether the new buildings would be appropriate or not. And a different situation occurred in Harlem when Stryper's Row was threatened, and the neighborhood did fight to save that.
Well, and I can't stress enough that the people take for granted now. You know, you walk down a street or you walk through a neighborhood and you see a beautiful row of buildings, and you know, people, I think, become complacent and just kind of imagine, well, they've always been here, they'll always be here, it's taken care of. And that's one of the things I'm trying to awaken awareness of in this book, is that the reason those buildings are there is because somebody before us fought like Dickens to keep them there, and we have to continue that.
Two other cases, Grand Central's Terminal, right, and Carnegie Hall.
Yeah. Great battles.
And was Grand Central Terminal the turning point? Was that the reason the Bard Law was finally passed?
No, actually, it's an irony that the threat to Grand Central that helped lead Bard to draft the act, and then the act was passed in 1956, that threat kind of then subsumed. And there was almost a drumbeat in the early 60s of other threats. Carnegie Hall was certainly one of them. There was the Huntington-Hartford Pavilion, which was planned for a corner of Central Park that very much disturbed the civic community. There was just a whole list of buildings that today we, you know, cherish that were kind of up for grabs and in play. And frankly, I think because the situation was perceived as being so out of control that ultimately when the law had been drafted, the mayor almost had no choice but to sign it because it looked like the city was out of control. Particularly, it was the demolition of the Brokaw mansions that really created finally the political will to sign the law.
James Felt, who was New York City Planning Commissioner under Mayor Wagner, was a strong advocate.
He was. There's an interesting unknown question about Felt. Felt was clearly the political rabbi, helping the civic groups and Municipal Arts Society and the others work their way through the process to get a landmarks law. And he guided them and helped them as they were brought into government to sit on committees and on the first commission that was drafting the law. At the same time, and this is one of the great unknowns, it was his brother, Irving Felt, who was behind the demolition of Penn Station. And today, when I talk to people who are involved picketing to save Penn Station, they regard James Felt, in their mind, as a villain, though the people who helped the preservationists most involved with getting the Landmarks Law passed, people like Jeffrey Platt, Harmon Goldstone, regarded Felt as a real savior and supporter.
Now, there are some buildings that are threatened today that people would have liked to have been protected by the Landmarks Law. For example, Yankee Stadium.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that we haven't the complacency is, I think, not among some activists, but citywide. And I think we're going to have to wake up and realize that Yankee Stadium should have been safe. But this is a political process. I mean, in a sense, the law has to be. There has to be a political body that ultimately, at a certain point, says, yes, something's a landmark or not. So there has to be a demonstrated constituency to stand up to the natural pressures from the real estate industry. And so that's what's needed today, or we will continue to lose buildings.
Does it matter who wants to knock the buildings down? For example, we have the Columbia University expansion, which would destroy some landmark buildings. And then we have NYU in the Village, which has been accused of
NYU has been eating up the Village since the beginning of time. It's one of the sub-themes in the book. Look, we live in a city of political forces, and I think that one of the wake-up calls to the preservation community and the civic community is if we want our values to have a chance to survive, we have to be as politically active. And certainly the ownership of a building, the reality is that's part of the dynamics of trying to make something happen in the city.
What do you think of the redevelopment of Washington Square Park?
I haven't followed that one closely. I kind of think I've been in a cave for a couple of years writing the book. I will say that the history of debate over Washington Square Park goes back at least to Moses' proposal in the 1930s. In 1930, I think 36 was one of them. And he had one statement about that the Village was, there were more opinions you could find in the Village than anywhere else. And I guess my personal feeling is that advocates are so important, and so that people who feel that the process gets messy, gets delayed, time and again it's been citizen activists who've wakened up the city and prevented awful things from happening. So in a sense, and Bard, back to Bard, he, in fighting Moses on Castle Clinton, he wrote a letter to a friend basically saying, can we prevent the city from making this huge error? And fortunately then they were able to.
Now, how old does a building have to be before it can be landmarked?
The city law is 30 years.
A gorgeous building that was built 29 years ago can be knocked down even if everybody loves it because it's not protected by the law.
If the one person who doesn't love it is the owner, yes. So
then we have people like Harry Macklow who just simply hit a building with a demolition ball,
right.
Then you have to take it down.
Yeah, and I mean, I've been in preservation battles over the years where, I mean, the developers, many of them have a different goal and a different vision for the city, and they're going to do everything they can to achieve that vision. And we have to do everything we can to achieve our vision.
Despite the law, are there still treasures that are endangered?
Absolutely.
What are some of them?
Many of them, believe it or not, are our religiously owned buildings in New York just because of changing dynamics and economics.
St. Bart's had a big fight recently.
Well, that was years ago, and the good news is St. Bart's is now leading a huge campaign to restore itself. So that's a wonderful, wonderful story that they've come to recognize and appreciate the building and are looking for help to keep it up. But right now, a wonderful little kind of rural-looking church in Queens, St. Xavier's, is heading to the garbage heap. It's going to be destroyed. St. Bridget's is, I think, still hanging, about to be lost. St. Anne's was lost. St. Thomas in Harlem, an incredibly beautiful church, is on the way out. And these losses continue to mount.
Are they not protected because they are not owned by because they're nonprofits?
It's
owned by religious institutions?
The Landmarks Law does not require owner consent. Unfortunately, over the last number of years, you know, I think starting largely under the Giuliani administration, the Landmarks Commission has, I would say, lost a lot of its guts and its willingness to intervene where sometimes it really needs to. And though it doesn't require the permission of an owner, that has almost de facto become a practice in the last 14 or 15 years. And you know, that's another reason why history is so important. It reminds you of what things used to be.
Do you think that the Landmarks Law can be strengthened to protect it against political pressures? For example, if I were the mayor of New York and one of my chief donors was a real estate developer, I might very well pressure the Landmarks Commission to look the other way.
Well, and indeed, there are a number of people today working to try and strengthen the independence of the commission because the political dynamic seems to be greater now than it has been in the past. I'm not sure if legislatively that could be strengthened with the law, but I think it also comes back to a political constituency. If New Yorkers are going to let that happen, are going to step back and allow a mayor at some time to do that, it'll happen. But I think also if the people of the city stand up and create an expectation that's different, then there's real hope.
How much power do community boards have in this whole process?
They're a useful voice, but they have no ultimate power. And I'm afraid that, you know, the deal with community boards is if they support your position, they're the most important body in New York. If they oppose you, they don't matter. They certainly are a useful voice. They've been a wonderful voice for preservation. And, you know, kind of, and you just need those multiple voices.
Do we have to get people out to picket every time one of the treasures is threatened?
I would like to think we didn't have to, but as one who was picketing around Two Columbus Circle recently, I'd hoped my picketing days were behind me.
And you want to protect the Huntington-Hartford museum.
Yep.
You want it to look like the way it looked? Because some people love that building.
Oh, I wanted it preserved the way it was as a piece of architecture.
Edward Durrell Stone's building.
And I think that's not, you know, my personal style architecture, but I think it had earned that. But one of the great frustrations of that battle, and to your point about the political dimension today, is that building could not even get a public hearing, a full public hearing. And almost everybody, even those who didn't think it was worthy of a landmark, felt the process was important. And that really undercuts something like the law, which was all about creating a process so we wouldn't have to lose buildings unnecessarily.
We have an odd situation there where people don't love the architecture, so they're willing to allow the law to be bypassed, whereas in other cases they're not.
Well, you know, preservation isn't a beauty contest. It's about architecture, culture, and history. And sometimes history isn't pretty, but it's still important to save.
Anthony C. Wood's book, Preserving New York, Winning the Right to Protect a City's Landmarks, is published by Routledge. And a reminder that we have a slideshow of some of the buildings that we have lost, unfortunately, on our website at wnyc.org. Just check out our show page. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks.
It's just like Grand Central Station.
Grand Central Terminal will celebrate its 100th anniversary this coming Saturday. a momentous occasion for one of New York's most visited landmarks, especially notable because it was once slated for demolition. Sam Roberts, the urban affairs correspondent for the New York Times and host of New York Times Close-Up Show on New York One, has told the story of this icon of New York's Gilded Age in a new book from Grand Central Publishing called Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America. It covers Cornelius Vanderbilt's railroad empire, a long-forgotten engineer named William Wilgus, who electrified the trains, and the historical preservation movement that helped save the terminal from the wrecking ball. I'm very pleased that it has brought Sam Roberts back to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, thanks for inviting me.
Now, is it just a coincidence that your publisher is named Grand Central?
I think that's synergy, we can call that. I think they fell in love with the idea and decided why not? That's the old Warner Books and renamed when they actually moved right near to Grand Central.
Now, the song we just heard called the Grand Central Station, and that's not its name. That's the post office down the block?
It's the post office down the block. It's the subway station beneath Grand Central, but Grand Central is indeed a terminal. It's a terminal, I think, for two reasons. One, trains originally and now terminate there. The other is that Penn Station was being built on the other side of town, and the Vanderbilt family wanted to say, we have the best and biggest railroad terminal in the world.
Well, the current station is not in its the original one, is it?
No, there was an original one that opened as Grand Central Depot in 1871. And when it opened, the New York Times said, it's neither Grand nor Central. What's it doing all the way up on 42nd Street? And what's so fascinating about the development of Grand Central was the Vanderbilts brought Midtown Manhattan to their doorstep. That spurred development that's going on to this day.
So we have Grand Central Terminal, Commodore Vanderbilt, Cornelius Vanderbilt, who is one of the key figures in American industrial history, or railroad history anyway, and he's in competition with the Cassatts and the Pennsylvania Railroad. So they pretty much are building their buildings at the same time?
They are. The first decade of the 20th century, the Pennsylvania Railroad finally decided that because of electrification, they could build a tunnel under the Hudson River. And before that, they were literally ferrying passengers from New Jersey. And after a fatal accident in the Park Avenue Tunnel, I discovered in writing the book that William Wilgus, who you mentioned, who was the chief engineer of the New York Central, said, we've got to electrify this railroad. That allowed them to deck over Park Avenue and for the first time monetize what became known as air rights.
How did he even come up with the idea? This is a man of limited education, wasn't he?
Well, he was. I think it's one of those things where someone reads the law. In this case, he probably apprenticed himself to an engineer as opposed to getting an engineering degree. He took a correspondence course from Cornell, in fact. But he rose very quickly to become chief engineer of the railroad, and they had faith in him and bought into his premise.
So when he came up with the idea, they said, okay, it's good. We're ready to spend, I guess it would even then be millions of dollars to electrify?
Well, that's one of the things that so fascinated me about Grand Central, that here was a private enterprise, and almost all the money for Grand Central came out of the Vanderbilt's pockets. They said, even though we make most of our money on freight, not on passenger service, we are going to make this a monument, a majestic cathedral. And they did that. And then now, almost 100 years later, a government entity wound up doing the same thing.
Well, Cassatt hired McKim, Mead & White, the most famous architectural firm in the area at the time. Who did Vanderbilt hire to make the building that we know and love on 42nd Street?
Well, it turned out that Grand Central was greater than the sum of its parts. There were two architectural firms hired. One was Reed and Stem, which sounds more like a landscape architectural firm. The other was Warren and Whitmore. Reed and Stem was related to Wilgus, the chief engineer. Warren and Whitmore had a better in. They were related to the Vanderbilts, and therefore they formed a combine and jointly designed the terminal.
And in this case, a building made by committee turns out to be pretty good.
It did. It is greater than the sum of its parts.
William Wilgus also invented the concept of air rights?
Yes, he did. They realized that, and we forget this, and again, during doing the book, I either re-remembered it or discovered it for the first time, that Park Avenue, what is now Park Avenue, was a giant trench in the middle of Manhattan that bisected Manhattan, almost from Lexington to Madison Avenues all the way up to 59th Street. And electrification meant they could deck it over. There was no smoke, no cinders from that. And they monetized all of that value and created billions of dollars of real estate.
Well, Cornelius Vanderbilt had built a subway on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, but that was before electrification, and that's why that doesn't exist anymore?
That doesn't exist anymore. There were a lot of experiments with that, including sort of pneumatic tubes, the Albert Beach subway. And he also had an antipathy toward railroads when he was known as the Commodore. He was interested in passenger traffic up and down the Hudson.
So how did he get involved with railroads?
Well, he got involved because, interestingly enough, a railroad was able to take passengers going from Long Island to New England because the New England coast was hilly. So it was easier to take his ferry across and then pick up a railroad around Bridgeport or farther east. And he became interested in it and realized that that was the future.
And then he took control of New York Central or created New York Central?
He took control. It was an amalgam of dozens and dozens of railroads all over New York State and all over the Northeast. And Vanderbilt took control ruthlessly in the way robber barons did in that day. But the good news is they amassed enough money to be able to build a monument like Grand Central.
My guest is Sam Roberts. His latest book, Grand Central, How a Train Station Transformed America, as a foreword by Pete Hamill. At the time they decided to build this new Grand Central, the railroad company didn't own the land that they needed. Can you describe the political wheeling and dealing that had to be done to acquire the land?
Well, they didn't own the land, but they did own the New York State Legislature, which made it a lot easier. And what they were able to do...
I guess nothing's changed.
Nothing has changed. What they were able to do is get through legislation that said the railroad had the right to condemn the property and allow it to be adjudicated by the courts in its own version of eminent domain. So they bought all that land in Midtown Manhattan. It was all open railroad tracks. And ultimately, when they decked it over, they were able to monetize those air rights and create a property that is enormously valuable.
So, we have the Chrysler Building across the street. They probably wouldn't have built it and some of the other wonderful buildings in the area if the terminal hadn't been built.
That's true. That's why I said the terminal, one of the things I discovered in researching this, the terminal really brought Midtown to its doorstep.
Were there cost overruns, as there always seemed to be in projects like
this? Well, it would cost about $2 billion in today's money, and it was very expensive. And again, the railroad said, why are we doing this? Why are we investing so much in passenger traffic when we make most of our money on freight? But it was a showcase for the railroad. They wanted to say, we are the big New York Central Railroad. We care about our commuters.
And with passenger service around the country pretty much in decline, we still see thriving railroads going out of this station and Penn Station. You say it also changed Park Avenue. And didn't it lead to the development of the suburbs in Westchester and Connecticut?
It certainly did. The whole concept of commuting really began at Grand Central. And, you know, it's funny. When I started the book, the subtitle is How a Train Station Transformed America. And I said, am I really going to be able to live up to this?
America rather than the Northeast of or the New York
or
metropolitan
Manhattan
area.
Exactly. And it turns out that it really did in so many ways, in urban planning and air rights and landmarks preservation with Jackie Onassis. Standard Time started at Grand Central Station. Arguably, the civil rights movement was nurtured there with A. Philip Randolph and the sleeping car porters.
Now, how different is it today from when it was built?
I'd say it's even better. It's hard to believe that a station built 100 years ago serves now more than 80 million passengers a year, more than ever before.
Well, it's also in a magnificent space, and it has that famous ceiling.
It has the famous ceiling, and one of the secrets I learned about Grand Central is the ceiling is backwards. A commuter noticed that just a couple of days after the terminal opened in 1913, looked up at that celestial ceiling and discovered the constellations are all backwards.
Now, Grand Central was eventually slated for the same fate as its old rival, Penn Station, and people wanted to tear it down, or somebody wanted to tear it down in the 1960s. Who owned the terminal at the time, and what did they plan to put up there?
Well, it was owned by Penn Central, the bankrupt railroad, and what they wanted to do was put up a new skyscraper that would produce revenue for the railroad from rents and other items. And the city came along, and what it showed was that Penn Station did not die in vain. Jack Ioannidis was instrumental in galvanizing a movement to save Grand Central.
We have a clip with Jackie Ioannidis, and do we want to call it Jackie Kennedy Ioannidis?
At the time, Jackie Kennedy Ioannidis.
I think it's so terribly important, and we've all heard that it's too late or that it has to happen or that it's inevitable, but I don't think that's true, because I think if there is a great effort, even if it's at the 11th hour, you can succeed, and I think, and I know that that's what we'll do.
And the threat to destroy Grand Central helped to form the Landmarks Preservation Society?
It did indeed. One of the things I didn't realize when I started the book is that the city almost did not appeal the decision, saying it had no right to landmark Grand Central. The city was financially strapped at the time. They were worried about liability. The Penn Central said, we'll sue you if you don't withdraw the landmark status. And it was really Jack Ioannidis' intervention that galvanized the movement.
Well, there's often pressure from all sorts of places. Construction industry and the unions would have wanted to have put up a new building. The only thing that would have been lost was this magnificent edifice.
Well, what it proves is that Penn Station at least did not die in vain. People, I think, realized, the Municipal Arts Society and others, that when this happened, we're not going to let it happen again.
And then Metro North took over in 1983, and they began making improvements?
Making improvements. Peter Stengel at Metro North, one of the heroes of this story in the book, they came along and said, in light and self-interest, we're going to spend the money, we're going to restore this place, and they've done it meticulously so that it is probably in some respects more pristine than it was when it opened.
Well, it also has been a place where art exhibits have been presented, where there have been some wonderful restaurants over the years. Isn't there also some kind of a hidden railroad link with the Wall of Astoria?
Yes, there is. It is hidden. It was used by FDR, among other presidents. There's a link directly under the Waldorf and an elevator that leads to that.
Is it still being used?
Well, one of the secrets I learned in doing the book is that when the President of the United States is in town and staying at the Waldorf, there is a train manned at the ready under the Waldorf to speed him out of town as an emergency egress in case there is some blockage on the street.
There are incredible things about this, not only the ceiling, which has 2,500 stars and 10 major constellations and zodiac signs. The bulbs are all bare. Why is that?
Well, good question. You'd think these ornate brass chandeliers would have globes on them or crystal on them. The bulbs are bare because the Vanderbilts wanted to show off the fact this was an all-electric railroad station.
We have a lovely slideshow of images of Grand Central Terminal from 1871 onward on our show page at WNYC.org. Are there any celebrations planned for the centennial that my listeners can attend?
Well, lots of celebrations on Friday, February 1st at Grand Central.
Well, you say that it really isn't Saturday. It's midnight. They actually started midnight Friday night?
The terminal opened midnight on February 1st, so the first full day was February 2nd. The first train, I think, left at about 12:03 for Boston.
And how many people were there?
Well, by the mid-afternoon of that Sunday, 150,000 people had trooped through Grand Central.
So the public thought this was a great idea. They loved the building from the start?
From the very beginning, they loved it. And I just wish, you know, when you go to it today, we wouldn't take it for granted and would, you know, take a little bit of time to gawk at it.
We don't have much time, but how did you get involved in this project?
Well, it's interesting. I have a long involvement with Grand Central. When I was a little kid, my father took me to visit, and an engineer saw me staring at this giant locomotive and said, hey, you want to drive this thing? Put me on his lap, put my hand on the throttle, and I drove it what probably was a few feet but seemed like miles.
Sam Roberts is the author of 7 nonfiction books, the editor of an 8th, and he has covered New York for the Daily News and the New York Times, also on New York One. His book, Grand Central, published by Grand Central. In September, it was announced that the Bullmore Lanes on University Place was to be demolished and replaced by a 23-story tower, just the latest example of the transformation of a traditionally low-rise neighborhood in which small-scale buildings are gradually being replaced by much higher and larger ones. We've invited Michael Kimmelman, the New York Times architecture critic, and Andrew Berman, the executive director of the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation, to our show today to look at why this is happening now, how it may affect other neighborhoods in the city, and whether it's something we should be concerned about. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to our show. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Andrew, can you explain what's going on with the Bullmore site?
Sure. As you said, somewhat shockingly, there's a plan to build a 23-story, 308-foot-tall tower on the corner of University Place and 12th Street. And basically the reason is that's one of the parts of the village that is not landmarked, not located in a designated historic district, and where the zoning doesn't have any height caps, really allows very, very tall towers if you assemble a large enough site.
How tall is the building right now?
Oh, the building that's there is about four stories, so this would be exponentially taller.
It seems like every day we learn of the closing of a beloved business in the village. Just this week, we're losing two old-time Italian coffee houses, Di Roberta's and Bruno's.
Right.
Is this all a matter of just rent?
You know, part of it's rent. Part of it, I think, is the proliferation of chain stores. Part of it is, you know, some of it reflects the good things, which is that people want to live in these neighborhoods. There's greater competition. But I think we're not doing a great job of really managing that growth.
Well, I always wondered why people would want to live in a neighborhood where they appreciate that there is a Di Roberta's and their house is going to replace Di Roberta's. Michael, didn't you grow up in the village?
I did. Yeah.
How much has it changed since that time?
Oh, it's changed remarkably. I mean, I grew up on Downing Street. Downing Street was a kind of rundown alleyway. It was occupied by a very village mix of people. It was largely Italian neighborhood, but there was still a working class, middle class. Now Downing Street is unrecognizable.
And hip the village restaurants.
Hip restaurants and a lot of new housing that's been inserted into what used to be my backyard.
Right.
Yeah,
multi-million-dollar townhouses.
Yeah, I mean that's really, of course, it's the epicenter of inequity in the city.
This weekend, the Times published your scathing critique of the new One World Trade Center. You described it as monomaniacal. How is it monomaniacal?
You know, I mean, I should begin by saying that I was very thrilled. I was thrilled and moved by the reactions to that piece because obviously that building is a kind of Rorschach, as the site is, I think, for so many New Yorkers and people outside New York, too. So I understand that people have lots of different opinions. For me, I think the site is a disappointment, and the building itself is a symbolic of that, and monomaniacal in the sense that we had an opportunity to create a new, diverse place in the ruins of what was the fallen Twin Towers. And I think the building, the idea of building this giant super tall thing almost as a dare and creating this object, which to me is also not a very beautiful object, is monomaniacal.
Would a better design tall building have been more acceptable?
I mean, yes. I think the design, it was compromised in all sorts of ways. But I think, you know, buildings exist in a place. The places exist in neighborhoods and cities. And the larger question is, what kind of place are we making down there?
Well, there were also plans initially to put a drawing center there, a theater,
right,
art centers in general, and politics eliminated pretty much all of them. People were concerned by what would be exhibited, what would be performed there, and whether they would all be desecrations of the hallowed space. But instead we have this building that the only thing that distinguishes it from other tall buildings is that it's 1,776 feet high.
Yeah, sort of, if you include this antenna that they have.
Chicago doesn't accept that.
Right, nor probably should it. I mean, you're absolutely right. And you know, it's an interesting question. You know, what is it that we want to represent when we represent the rebuilt New York? I mean, it should be, I think, a place of vitality and diversity and energy and culture, and not a giant, office park essentially around a memorial.
You've also written critically about the new sliver buildings going up on 57th Street and that corridor.
I mean, You know, this relates to what Andrew was saying about the village. If you can assemble the right parcels in a place like 57th Street, you can also, because of the economics, because of changed economics, you can create an unusually slender but extremely tall building, because you can sell apartments at the top of these buildings for previously unimaginable prices, $100 million or something. You know, I think the questions that it raises are a little different than in the village. But the disturbing thing there, and I think it relates to when we're talking to villages, to what extent does all of this kind of development, it's not whether the buildings are too tall or too thin or too fat. It's really a question of how much they seem to represent a city that's getting away from the people who live here. How much is it changing around us in ways that don't seem to represent who we are?
Andrew, the financial district in Midtown are filled with skyscrapers. How did Greenwich Village, which is situated between them, wind up being built on a much smaller scale? Is it just a matter of Manhattan schist?
No, it's really an incredible story. I mean, of course, Greenwich Village, as the name implies, was originally a village north of New York City and what's today the financial district. The city moved north and absorbed it, but it already had this idiosyncratic street grid and these small houses. And over the years, the residents, even as the neighborhood changed, worked very, very hard to try to hold on to that unique sense of place, that sense of a village apart from the city. They were able to legally do that in 1969, after the Landmarks Law was passed, when a big chunk, but not all of the neighborhood, was protected by historic district designation and some very early zoning protections that were meant to help reinforce the row house nature of the neighborhood. But there's many, many holes in those, and we're seeing them driving some pretty large buildings through those holes these days.
Were those zoning regulations intended to limit the heights of buildings in this mostly residential neighborhood?
Well, zoning is a pretty blunt tool. And in fact, until recently, it rarely, if ever, said this is the absolute height of a new building you could build. But it might say you can only build this number of square feet unless you acquire development rights from neighboring sites. In the last 20 or 30 years, we've had what's called contextual zoning, which actually does put in place height limits and sort of prescribes exactly what the envelope of a new building should look like. So you can say, well, in this neighborhood, 5 and 6 story buildings make sense, or in this neighborhood, 10 or 12 story buildings make sense, as opposed to what you see on 57th Street, where if you pile up enough development rights, the sky literally is the limit.
And you can buy air rights.
Yeah, and certainly that's not what I think you want in a place like Greenwich Village.
Well, you mentioned that some of Greenwich Village is landmarked as a historic district. What are the boundaries?
Yeah. Very irregular, but most of University Place and Broadway are not in it. Once you get up towards 13th and 14th Street, it's largely excluded. It's really the edges, the waterfront, West Street, Washington Street, and then until recently, the South Village, the area south of Washington Square Park where Michael grew up, was also not designated, even though people think of that in many ways as the heart of Greenwich Village.
Michael, was that around the same time that the Landmarks Preservation Commission was created, after the demolition of the original Penn Station?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I'd like to say I grew up in Jane Jacobs' neighborhood. And, of course, she was instrumental in preventing that highway from going what would have been not very far from my house, straight through the village.
The commission can designate both individual buildings and whole neighborhoods.
Yes.
But why not the complete Greenwich Village?
Well, there was a huge battle over that in the 1960s. The residents, Jane Jacobs, actually did want the entire neighborhood designated. The city wanted a series of tiny 18 or 19 little islands of small historic districts. What we got was sort of a compromise, a cross between the two, a large chunk of the central part of the neighborhood, but most of the edges to the north, south, east, and west not included. And in the last 10 years, we've been able to expand those boundaries. We've gotten about 1,000 more buildings added to the district. But there's still a lot of places that people think of as the heart of the neighborhood, like University Place, where unfortunately you can tear down a building and build a 300-foot tall tower in its place.
My guests are Andrew Berman, the executive director of the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation, and Michael Kimmelman, who is the architecture critic at the New York Times. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Michael, isn't there an apartment shortage in New York City? Lots of people want to live here. If we don't build these taller buildings, where are they going to live? And if we build more, if we provide more apartments, won't that bring prices down?
Yes. So, I mean, I think this is a very important question because we shouldn't confuse the buildings that are, say, going up on 57th Street with the kind of housing that the city needs. Whether the city needs luxury housing of that sort is was one question. But those slender towers we're talking about, and certainly the tower that would rise 300 feet on University, is for very rich people who can pay many millions of dollars. So the question—
Usually isn't there a deal where a few apartments have to be set aside for low and middle income families?
That depends entirely on the site and whether it's as of right and whether there are any other restrictions on the developer in building those projects. And, you know, one of the arguments that I think could come up but hasn't yet, but it occurred to me in the process of thinking about 57th Street was, you know, very tall buildings don't occupy only the plot of land they stand on. They also occupy this, what you might call the public space of the skyline. They change the city. They're visible from other places. And in return for claiming some place on the skyline, should these buildings have some responsibility in some way beyond whatever may come to them as of right?
A listener, Tom from Astoria, wrote in on our show page, "I'm a painter working on a series of paintings of the Chrysler Building from various angles. I was shocked and saddened to hear that the entire block adjacent to Grand Central and the Chrysler is slated to be torn down. Developers are getting everything they want, and the new structure will be 150 feet taller than the Chrysler Building."
So there's development that will be happening next to Grand Central, right? There's a very tall office building that will be going up there.
Wasn't that a historic building next to Grand Central?
That's not a historic site along Vanderbilt. And, in fact, one of the plans of the outgoing Bloomberg administration was to upzone Vanderbilt dramatically to allow the potential for extremely high buildings along that corridor. One of them was already in the works and will be going up, and it will have a large public component on the ground floor too. I mean, yes, the skyline is certainly going to change. I mean, the Empire State Building is going to look relatively small, I think, compared to not only that building but some of the buildings rising on 57th Street. I mean, it's not necessarily – I don't personally think that it's a question that height in is, of itself is a problem. We have been a city of change, a city of height. It's – I think you raised earlier the important question, who occupies these buildings? Who are they for? And then I think entering into a conversation as a city about what our priorities are, if that space on the skyline is public space, to what does the developer owe the rest of the city? That kind of thing, I think, is at least a healthy conversation for us to have.
Andrew, what does the designation historic district mean? Are there zoning restrictions which specify building height, materials, architectural style, signage?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're a designated historic district, it means that changes are now regulated by the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission, a public agency. Basically, in order to become a historic district, you have to sort of prove or show that throughout this area there's an architectural, cultural, or historic significance, a distinctive character that should be protected and perpetuated. Doesn't mean nothing ever changes. There can be alterations to existing buildings that are not that important that just happen to be within the district can be torn down and replaced, but the replacement has to conform to the approval of the Landmarks Preservation Commission, has to contribute to that special sense of place.
And I would assume that in the village, the area around Washington Square is all landmarked.
One would assume
it's so
that,
important historically.
But that is
not Henry
the
James
case.
Lived there.
Yes. Well, in fact, until just a couple of years ago, only the north and west side of Washington Square was landmarked. Now the south side is as well, most of it. The east side still is not. So there's a lot of parts of our neighborhood with some incredible history that are still very, very vulnerable and, you know, subject to demolition and out-of-scale new construction at any time.
And, of course, NYU is planning some very large-scale development on the south side.
That's right.
On LaGuardia Place,
which
south of Washington
Square. Which has caused a huge uproar, even among NYU's faculty.
Yes.
But how does an area get landmarked, Michael? Is the process generally initiated by a group of neighborhood residents or business owners?
Well, I don't know how often it's the business owners, but I think it's usually the residents. I mean, I don't know the technical process, which Andrew would know.
Well, you know, ultimately the commission makes these decisions. Oftentimes it's initiated by community groups like the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation or, you know, hundreds of neighborhood groups throughout the city. Anybody, any individual can submit what's called a request for evaluation to the Landmarks Preservation
and
Commission.
And what criteria do you cite?
You can cite anything, but the things that really speak to what the law is intended to protect is that there's a special historic significance, architectural significance, cultural significance that's in some way embodied in the physicality of the building. You know, sometimes it can be a little more challenging when you're talking about something that might have happened at a site, but there's nothing per se about the building that shows that that's what happened there. But if the building in some way reflects this great piece of history, the Chrysler Building, for instance, really speaks to the automobile age. Other buildings, you might have had a great American who lived there, but there's nothing about the building that tells you much about that person.
I remember when there were rumors that the Lever House would be knocked down. A friend said, "Oh my, I picketed when they knocked down the building that the Lever House replaced, and now I'm going to have to picket again to protect the Lever House."
Yeah. Sure. Well, you know, the Chrysler Building, in fairness, the Chrysler Building was widely loathed when it opened. I mean, the idea that it's now a cherished monument would
and many people think the New York's most beautiful building.
Yeah. I mean, for those people who say, look, let development just run free, they would say, look, there's an example of the Chrysler Building. And in fact, the Empire State Building, too, when it was built, of course, stuck up like a sore thumb. So, you know, again, there's nuance here. It's not that we want to preserve the city in amber. Right?
What are the practical implications, advantages or disadvantages of being designated historic district?
Well, the advantage, among other things, is that you really do get to protect the character of the neighborhood in a way that nothing else does. Zoning is a very blunt tool. Landmarking is much more fine-tuned. And some of our most cherished neighborhoods are landmarked, and the reason why they're so cherished is because of what the landmark designation protects.
Can you prevent buildings that are out of character with the neighborhood from being built?
Absolutely. Anything in order to be built requires the approval of the Landmarks Preservation Commission. Has to go through a public hearing process. Now, the commission are 11 individuals with their own opinions. Sometimes you might agree with them. Sometimes you might disagree with them. But they are charged by law with trying to protect that special character. And you can see the quality of buildings that are built in historic districts. I think it's easy to distinguish from a lot of those that are built outside of them.
My guests are Andrew Berman, the executive director of the Greenwich Village Society of Historic Preservation, and Michael Kimmelman, who is the New York Times architecture critic. We'll take a little break and come back with more. We are back with Michael Kimmelman, the New York Times architecture critic, and Andrew Berman, the executive director of the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. And we're talking about how zoning laws affect New York and how to come up with some kind of balance between a city that we want to change, because change has always been important to New York, and a city that also preserves its history and it's nicer buildings and a sense of neighborhood. This is a fight that has been going on in New York for a long time. Jane Jacobs, I guess, is the one who fought hardest for the village. Yeah. Robert Moses representing the other side of the story. Yeah. And both of them did positive and negative things along the way.
Sure. But I think without a doubt, we can say that Moses' plans for the village would have been a disaster. The entire neighborhood of Soho would have been wiped out. Much of Greenwich Village would have been. You know, we were talking about tall buildings and height before. I think another question is there are definitely places where large new development, tall new development belongs, and other places where it doesn't.
Michael, how are these historic districts monitored? Do developers have to submit plans to the city for approval before they begin construction?
Yeah, sure. If a site is landmarked, if an area is landmarked, certainly if a building they've acquired is landmarked, then there are enormous restrictions on them. But, you know—
Well, does anyone have the authority to say that curved glass building doesn't look very good next to the classic old brownstone, so you can't build it there?
I mean, this is an interesting question. I'd like to hear what Andrew says about this, too. I mean,
especially since what we've seen in Astor Place.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Landmarks Commission, as far as I know, is really the one city agency that is making aesthetic decisions on some level. In the end, it's deciding whether something is looks right. And that's a very complicated decision on a governmental level, you know, to hand government agencies the ability to make aesthetic judgments. At the same time, of course, we're so disappointed when buildings get built that are just appalling and look horrible. And 157 is a good example on 57th Street.
What can be done to mitigate the loss of sunlight from areas where tall buildings are built? And is that a consideration? I know that when they were thinking of building a replacement for the Coliseum, there was much talk about the shadow that would fall on Central Park, and plans were adjusted.
Yeah.
Of course, the new building, the Time Warner Building, is not exactly one of the great works of architecture of our time.
No, although in some ways that might have actually been a process that produced a better result. It's, one could argue this. I think in any case, with the buildings on 57th Street, many of those are so slender that the shadows, although I certainly understand that argument, I don't know that the shadows there are the biggest issue. I don't know how much of a shadow they'll cast into the park. But I do think that in a place like University Place, where you have a certain scale and also an openness of the sky, what is it about the village that makes the village? A lot of it has to do with the sense of an open sky, the level of the buildings at your eye. And so a tall building on a place like University would cast not just a shadow, but would change in a certain sense your perception of the whole neighborhood.
The area around Astor Place and Cooper Union has been drastically changed since the addition of several large glass structures which seem out of place with their neighbors, the main Cooper Union building, the public theater, the old Astor Library. Is this area outside of the historic district, even though those two buildings are quite historic?
It is. The older buildings that you mentioned are individually landmarked, but the neighborhood itself is not. And that's part of the reason why you have these sort of jarringly contrasting new glass and steel buildings going up. Although in those cases, interestingly, they did need some zoning changes from the city. So the city, in a sense, actually gave their approval to it.
Michael, why do these protections seem to be falling by the wayside now?
Yeah, you know, there are obviously pressures on the city, and you mentioned one of them, one of the big ones, the desire to create more housing. So,
but you didn't say affordable housing.
Right.
Because they always talk about affordable housing, and then there isn't too much affordable housing.
Well, of course, affordable is one of those words, affordable to whom, and what does that actually mean? But that creates, I think, a complex dynamic between the city and developers. The city needs to rely on developers because, of course, we no longer live during the, you know, FDR days when there was enormous federal funding for public housing. So there is a desire to accommodate development. At the same time, the city needs to get out of that some kind of compensation in terms of housing.
To what extent are institutions forced to sell land or air rights for development in order to raise funds? Thinking of the Frick and also the Cathedral of St. John the Divine.
Right. I mean, the religious institutions especially have, you know, this problem. You can sell air rights to adjacent sites, but in Times Square, I believe, that for historic theaters, the Bloomberg administration worked out something so that the theaters could be preserved and the air rights could be spread more widely in the neighborhood so that the theaters could be saved. But for a case like St. John the Divine, you know, they're really in a big financial hole, and therefore they have sold off part of their properties to these big buildings, which in a sense are, you know, tragic because that's a great site, and in a way they impede the historic greatness of that very building.
Andrew, you sent us an alert yesterday about the Landmarks Preservation Commission's calendaring.
Yes.
100 structures being considered for landmark status.
Yeah.
Are these buildings all over the city?
Yeah, all five boroughs. And this is extremely disturbing, an unprecedented move by the commission. They're going to, with one vote next Tuesday, take off their docket 94 individual buildings in two historic districts throughout the five boroughs that have been under consideration for landmark designation. Their rationale is, they say, they want to kind of open up their agenda and free themselves to do new work. But really, a lot of these buildings are, in fact, eminently worthy of designation. There are some 200-year-old houses in our neighborhood. And instead of allowing the typical public comment and debate over the merits of each one, it's going to be a thumbs-up, thumbs-down vote on all 100 at once. And it's pretty much been pre-broadcast that it's going to be a thumbs-down vote.
So the public isn't invited.
the public cannot speak at this vote. Which
well,
is
and
a
also,
shame.
I mean, let's just say it's a rubber stamp for the, for turning them down en masse, and of course to have gotten on the calendar in the first place, there was some review process which got them there. So they could be returned to the calendar, but they'd have to go through the process again. This goes back to, what, the 1960s, these, mm-hmm. some of these
but doesn't this also go against everything that Bill de Blasio was campaigning for when he ran for mayor?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're told that this somehow increases transparency, but it actually seems to do the exact opposite.
Indeed.
We're told it should lighten the load for the commission, but in fact, as Michael said, given that these went through the process once, in order to bring them back, they'd have to go through the process again, so we'd be duplicating efforts. We know that this is something that the real estate industry has been asking for a long time, and they seem to now finally be getting.
Ashley commented on our show page, what will happen to Greenwood Cemetery now that it is on the list to be dropped from the Landmarks Preservation List?
Mm. Well, Greenwood Cemetery, the Pepsi-Cola sign.
But could they build on the Greenwood Cemetery site?
As a cemetery, there probably are certain unique restrictions that it has. But if it were landmarked, there would be certain aesthetic protections in terms of things like the gate posts and other things that are part of the history of the of that site that goes back more than 150 years.
But I believe the Bergdorf Goodman building, for instance, is on there too. So in the interim, while it's decalendared, that a developer could just tear the building down. It wouldn't. There would be no. I mean, I think Lenny brought up exactly the point about transparency, and this is a particularly curious thing that the administration would come in and then do something that seems so so counter to that idea.
Right. Now, Suzanne from Manhattan wonders about maximum population for a functioning area. People have been concerned about that, especially along the waterfront in Brooklyn and Queens.
I think that's part of the concern as well. You know, we obviously need more housing. We want more affordable housing. But there's also an issue of when are we being packed too densely, and really what's going to make the most livable neighborhoods. And oftentimes it seems there's not sufficient thought given to that. It's just a numbers game. We want this number of apartment units built. We're going to do this to try to get this number of affordable units built. And there rarely seems to be the holistic approach that it seems like we need.
Yeah, and there was a big to-do about the fact that there are double entrances to some of the new buildings for the poor people and the wealthier people.
Yeah. I mean, I think the density question is, in my mind, a little complicated because there are areas that could become more dense. And I think, you know, we are a dense city and density is one of the virtues of the city. But density in itself is not the question, I think. It's a question, as Andrew said, about the holistic approach. If you have a place where there's more housing, then you need more services. You need better transportation. You need better streets. I mean, it's not just a numbers game of putting up buildings. And I think that kind of holistic approach to city planning is really incumbent upon this administration if it wants to impose large-scale new housing in areas.
What about the Hudson Yards project, which has been described as the largest real estate development in U.S. history? It's being built on a platform over the rail yards going into Penn Station without disrupting train service. Isn't that a good way to create new development without destroying a neighborhood?
Well, I actually live not too far from there. I think it makes a lot of sense to develop over there. I know the issue that a lot of folks raised was this is tens of millions of square feet of space that's going to be built, and how much infrastructure are we building to accommodate that? One additional stop on the 7, and that's it. That train is going to get a lot more crowded over the next couple of years as those buildings come online.
Would that be the only public transportation serving this huge area?
There's existing public transportation, but I haven't heard much about that being increased. I mean, there's only so many buses you can send over there. Ferries can only handle so many people. You know, there was a lot of push around more schools, more sanitation facilities, things of that nature. You know, I think one of the biggest problems with Midtown Manhattan right now is the overcrowding and the lack of infrastructure to handle the increasing number of people coming in. I think that people would be more willing to accept larger buildings if they also knew that these things were coming along with them to make life make a little more sense.
And Michael, parts of Brooklyn like Dumbo and Williamsburg have become very hot real estate markets, Long Island City and Queens. Are we seeing the same kind of thing, replacement of low-rise buildings with tall towers there? And has there been the same kind of opposition?
Yeah, well, I mean, neighborhood by neighborhood, it's different. But absolutely, there are areas that, I mean, in Williamsburg, you have new development along the waterfront. Again, some of those areas can grow, and some of that development is welcome. And
except that when we have a Sandy, then people say, well, we shouldn't have developed along the waterfront.
Right. I mean, again, okay, so it's very specific to what kind of development. So, the you know, Brooklyn Bridge Park then ended up actually being a wonderful buffer during Sandy. Yeah, that wasn't bad development in and of itself. I think, you know, what we keep talking about here is a certain kind of placemaking, a mix of infrastructure, mixed neighborhoods, not just in terms of their uses, but the population there, and that occupies a new development or an old neighborhood that is changing. It's obviously complicated. It's the necessary city building, but I think that the fear in all of these questions about development is, as I said earlier, that I think so much of it seems driven by market rate housing that is increasingly unaffordable even for longtime New Yorkers, middle-class New Yorkers.
How can people protect their neighborhoods from these changes? Is there a way for residents to find out when buildings are sold, who's buying them, and whether there are plans for a massive construction project?
Well, if you're in a historic district, these sorts of things do have to go through a public review process. But if you don't, typically you read about it in the paper, at which point it's already a done deal. So we do need more done, I think, to allow the community to have a role in planning their future and to be made aware of what's going on, because it's going to affect all of us.
Do community boards have any say?
It varies. If you require a zoning change or if it's going through the landmarks approval process, they have an advisory vote. But if they don't, they typically read about it in the paper as well.
You know, it also, I mean, I think a good example would be a place like Gowanus. There's now really, I think, been some very interesting thinking by the city councilman there, Brad Lander, and other people in that area to try to imagine how the neighborhood can grow in a healthy way to essentially plan for new development that would maintain the character of that neighborhood, its diversity, but allow for new businesses to come in and a mix of housing. And that kind of thinking ahead and community-driven thinking that is nonetheless open to development, that I think is a very healthy thing.
We mentioned the NYU expansion project south of Washington Square. In January, a judge ruled that the project would result in alienation of parkland, but this fall the appellate division reversed that decision. Andrew, where does that project stand now?
Well, we've filed an appeal, and we're hoping to be heard by the state's highest court in Albany. We do believe that the principle of the sanctity of public parkland is an important one, not just for the village, but for the whole city. And we're hoping that ultimately we will prevail. There's good case law that backs us up. The city should not have given away this public land to NYU to build on and to turn into basically roof space for a giant subterranean complex that they'll be building. So we're hoping that we'll have our day and we'll prevail in court.
Mullen Stewart, and we have to deal with this very quickly, writes that the area along University Place downtown, are the rights the same throughout the city, air rights and such? Can they be eliminated in certain areas or amended?
Well, they can be. And in fact, we're having a big community meeting this Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Baha'i Center, 53 East 11th Street, to talk about how we might be able to do that for an area like University Place and Broadway corridors that don't currently have those kinds of protections.
My great thanks to both of you for being on our show today. My guests have been Andrew Berman, the executive director of the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation, and also Michael Kimmelman, who is now writing about architecture for the New York Times. Welcome back to New York, Michael, after all those years in Europe.
Yeah,
it's been a pleasure having both of you on our show today.
Thank you.
Great pleasure.